Now is going to be another scintillating episode of Night of the Living Tongue. And as you know, this is not just your variety show for all local experimental music, performance art, personalities, and unclassifiable behavior. It is your variety show for readers, storytellers, and fairy tales. And tonight is going to be one of those evenings for fairy tales, as a matter of fact. I have a very special thing. Some people who are not in my generation, but a lot of people who are generally in my generation will know what I mean when I say these two words, the bins. Richard, do you know about the bins? Oh, you don't see? There's a tiny bit of generation gap, but the bins are a goodwill, which is, maybe you might be catching, the bins are this large goodwill that used to be out in Milwaukee and has shifted around its Milwaukee location a little bit. And in the bins, it's basically a large warehouse filled with refuse, old dishes, old clothes, dirty, wet blankets on various occasions, with unclassifiable rotten smells coming from them. And since they literally are bins, these are piles that are, they bring these, you just have to imagine something like a big wheelbarrow. There's a storage room way in the back full of tons of these wheelbarrows of junk, and they wheel out a new bunch of junk every hour or two, and then the people get very excited and have to actually wrestle with each other to get through the junk, because you might see, say, the tip of a lampshade sticking up at the top. And so then you have five Russian ladies, you know, wearing babushkas and everything, fighting each other to get the lampshade. And then you have this other family over here where six different children are fighting to get a Barbie missing two arms. And, you know, all sorts of, it's a great place for human behavior, but it's also a great place for dead and dying cultural artifacts. So anyone who wonders where those albums that you never hear of go, the books you never hear of go, sometimes you find real gems in here. Books, for example, one of the books I shall be reading from tonight. That was a long preface to tell you how rare and special this book is.
That's what that smell is.
Yes, the bins coming out. No, actually, it actually has a little, it's a bit of an old, sweet, almost lavender-smelling library smell that you get in some old library books. And this one, because this is a fairy tale night, is called The Little Lame Prince and His Traveling Cloak, by an author you've never heard of and I've never heard of either. It simply says, by Miss Mulock. And you could pronounce that Mulock or Mulock or however you might want to say it, but I like to pronounce it Mulock, Miss Mulock, and which gives a bit more of an ominous, mystical connotation, Mulock. But The Little Lame Prince and His Traveling Cloak is a story, a fairy tale, a rather long fairy tale, which looks like it might have been written for the 10 to 15-year-old category, because it's in some ways very adult, and actually, if you like Kurt Vonnegut, I must say, there are many Vonnegutian touches in this book. So all of you who are going, oh, I don't know if I can sit around for a fairy tale for an hour, I've got better things to do, like drink a lot. Well, think again, because maybe you want to enter the land of whimsy, heartbreak, and wonderful wistfulness. This is a book written for misfits. Truly, if you've never belonged anywhere in your life and always wished you could be doing something else that your immediate environment doesn't seem to provide you, this is a book written for you to give you hope and heart. And if you've ever felt that you have been disabled or deformed or had some other problem that has made you completely misunderstood by all other living beings anywhere within a 3-mile radius, then this is the book for you. This is a special book, The Little Lame Prince and His Traveling Cloak. And because it's rather long for a children's fairy tale, I put all these little bookmarks in it, hoping I could get to it all. So I'm going to read you as many passages as I can from it and skip ahead and explain some of the action if I look up at the clock and think, oh, it's the time I should skip things. So without further ado, I want to tell you once again a very special story about a very special handicapped prince who is a beautiful, beautiful character who brought me to tears when I read this. This is a book that you all you adults out there, you should stay tuned for. You don't have to be a little kid to hear The Little Lame Prince and His Traveling Cloak. That looks like it was written sometime in the 1940s by Miss Mulock, the mysterious Miss Mulock. So, without further ado, I am going to start for you this wonderful, wonderful tale, which is my favorite fairy tale in the universe. Chapter 1. Yes, he was the most beautiful prince that ever was born. Of course, being a prince, people said this, but it was true besides. When he looked at the candle, his eyes had an expression of earnest inquiry, quite startling in a newborn baby. His nose, there was not much of it certainly, but what there was seemed an aquiline shape. His complexion was a charming, healthy purple. He was round and fat, straight-limbed and long. In fact, a splendid baby. And everybody was exceedingly proud of him, especially his father and mother, the king and queen of No Man's Land, who had waited for him during their happy reign of 10 years, now made happier than ever, to themselves and their subjects, by the appearance of a son and heir. The only person who was not quite happy was the king's brother, the heir presumptive, who would have been king one day had the baby not been born. But as His Majesty was very kind to him, and even rather sorry for him, insomuch that at the Queen's request he gave him a dukedom almost as big as a county, the Crown Prince, as he was called, tried to seem pleased. And let us hope he succeeded. The prince's christening was to be a grand affair. According to the custom of the country, there were chosen for him 24 godfathers and godmothers, who each had to give him a name and promise to do their utmost for him. When he came of age, he himself had to choose the name and the godfather or godmother that he liked best for the rest of his days. Meantime, all was rejoicing. Subscriptions were made among the rich to give pleasure to the poor, dinners and town halls for the working men, tea parties in the streets for their wives, and milk and bun feasts for the children in the schoolrooms. For No Man's Land, though I cannot point it out on any map or read of it in any history, was, I believe, much like our own or many another country. As for the palace, which was no different from other palaces, it was clean, turned out of the windows, as people say, with the preparations going on. The only quiet place in it was the room which, though the prince was 6 weeks old, his mother, the queen, had never quitted. Nobody said she was ill, however. It would have been so inconvenient. And as she said nothing about it herself, but lay pale and placid, giving no trouble to anybody, nobody thought much about her. All the world was absorbed in admiring the baby. The christening day came at last, and it was as lovely as the prince himself. All the people in the palace were lovely too, or thought themselves so, and the elegant new clothes which the queen, who thought of everybody, had taken care to give them, from the ladies in waiting down to the poor little kitchen maid, who looked at herself in her pink cotton gown and thought, doubtless, that there was never such a pretty girl as she. By 6 in the morning, all the royal household had dressed itself in its very best, and then the little prince was dressed in his best, his magnificent christening robe, which, preceding His Royal Highness, did not like at all, but kicked and screamed like any common baby. When he had a little calmed down, they carried him to be looked at by the queen, his mother, who, though her royal robes had been brought and laid upon the bed, was, as everybody well knew, quite unable to rise and put them on. She admired her baby very much, kissed and blessed him, and lay looking at him, as she did for hours sometimes when he was placed beside her fast asleep. Then she gave him up with a gentle smile, and saying she hoped he would be very good, that it would be a very nice christening, and all the guests would enjoy themselves. turned peacefully over on her bed, saying nothing more to anybody. She was a very uncomplaining person, the queen, and her name was Dolores. Everything went on as exactly as if she had been present. All, even the king himself, had grown used to her absence, for she was not strong, and for years had not joined in any gaieties. She always did her royal duties, but as to pleasures, they could go on quite well without her, or so it seemed so. The company arrived, great and notable persons in this and neighboring countries, also the 24 godfathers and godmothers who had been chosen with care as the people who would be most useful to his royal highness should he ever want friends, which did not seem likely. What such want could possibly happen to the heir of the powerful monarch of no man's land? They came, walking two and two, with their coronets on their heads, being dukes and duchesses, princes and princesses, or the like. They all kissed the child and pronounced the name which each had given him. Then the 24 names were shouted out with great energy by 6 heralds, one after the other, and afterwards written down to be preserved in the state records in readiness for the next time they were wanted, which would be either on His Royal Highness's coronation or his funeral. Soon the ceremony was over, and everybody satisfied, except perhaps the little prince himself, who moaned faintly under his christening robes, which nearly smothered him. In truth, though very few knew, the prince, in coming to the chapel, had met with a slight disaster. His nurse, not his ordinary one, but the state nursemaid, an elegant and fashionable young lady of rank, whose duty it was to carry him to and from the chapel, had been so occupied in arranging the train with one hand, while she held the baby with the other, that she stumbled and let him fall just at the foot of the marble staircase. To be sure, she contrived to pick him up again the next minute, and the accident was so slight it seemed hardly worth speaking of. Consequently, nobody did speak of it. The baby had turned deadly pale, but did not cry, so no person, not a step or two behind, could discover anything wrong. Afterwards, if he had moaned, the silver trumpets were loud enough to drown his voice. It would have been a pity to let anything trouble such a day of felicity. So after a minute's pause, the procession had moved on. Such a procession! Heralds in blue and silver, pages in crimson and gold, and a troop of little girls in dazzling white, carrying baskets of flowers which they strewed all the way before the nurse and child. Finally, the 24 godfathers and godmothers, as proud as possible, and so splendid to look at, that they would have quite extinguished their small godson, merely a heap of lace and muslin with a baby face inside, had it not been for a canopy of white satin and ostrich feathers which was held over him wherever he was carried. Thus, with the sun shining on them through the painted windows, they stood, the king in his train on one side, the princes in attendance on the other, as pretty a sight as ever was seen out of fairyland. "It's just like fairyland," whispered the eldest little girl to the next eldest as she shook the last rose out of her basket. "And I think the only thing the prince wants now is a fairy godmother."
"Does he?"
said a shrill but soft and not unpleasant voice behind, and there was seen among the group of children somebody. Not a child, yet no bigger than a child. Somebody whom nobody had seen before, and who certainly had not been invited, for she had no christening clothes on. She was a little old woman dressed all in gray. Gray gown, gray hooded cloak, of a material excessively fine, and a tint that seemed perpetually changing like the gray of an evening sky. Her hair was gray, and her eyes also. Even her complexion had a soft gray shadow over it. But there was nothing unpleasantly old about her, and her smile was as sweet and childlike as the prince's own, which stole over his pale little face the instant she came near enough to touch him.
"Take care. Don't let the baby fall again."
The grand young lady nurse started, flushing angrily. "Who spoke to me? How did anybody know? I mean, what business has anybody? Then, frightened, but still speaking in a much sharper tone than I hope young ladies of rank are in the habit of speaking, "Old woman, you will be kind enough not to say the baby, but the prince. Keep away. His Royal Highness is just going to sleep. Nevertheless, I must kiss him. I am his godmother." "You?" cried the elegant lady nurse. "You?" repeated all the gentlemen and ladies in waiting. "You?" echoed the heralds and pages, and they began to blow the silver trumpets in order to stop all further conversation. The prince's procession formed itself for returning, the king and his train having already moved off towards the palace. But on the topmost step of the marble stairs stood, right in front of all, the little old woman clothed in gray. She stretched herself on tiptoe by the help of her stick and gave the little prince 3 kisses. "This is intolerable," cried the young lady nurse, wiping the kisses off rapidly with her lace handkerchief. "Such an insult to his Royal Highness. Take yourself out of the way, old woman, or the king shall be informed immediately." "The king knows nothing of me, more's the pity," replied the old woman with an indifferent air, as if she thought the loss was more on his majesty's side than hers. "My friend in the palace is the king's wife." "King's wives are called queens," said the lady's nurse with a contemptuous air. "You are right," replied the old woman. "Nevertheless, I know her majesty well, and I love her and her child. And since you dropped him on the marble stairs..." She said this in a mysterious whisper which made the lady tremble in spite of her anger. "I choose to take him for my own. I am his godmother, ready to help him whenever he wants me."
"You help him!" cried all the group, breaking into shouts of laughter, to which the little old woman paid not the slightest attention. Her soft gray eyes were fixed on the prince, who seemed to answer to the look, smiling again and again in causeless, aimless fashion, as babies do smile. "His Majesty must hear of this," said a gentleman in waiting.
"His Majesty will hear quite enough news in a minute or two," said the old woman sadly. And again, stretching up to the little prince, she called him on the forehead. She kissed him on the forehead solemnly. "Be called by a new name which nobody has ever thought of. Be Prince Dolor, in memory of your mother, Dolores."
"In memory of?"
Everyone started at the ominous phrase, and also as at the most terrible breach of etiquette which the old woman had committed. Anyway, you get the picture. The fairy godmother has kissed Prince Dolor and named him. And the news which is about to be told to everyone in the court is that during all the festivities, the mother has died. And I'm going to skip ahead in the plot a bit, simply because this is a long and beautiful tale, but we do not have time for all of the long and beautiful tale. So, I will skip ahead to the part where the young... And there's a lot of magic and great things going to happen, but I should give you a tiny bit more about the young prince as he grows into his toddlerhood, and they discover that this bright and beautiful baby, who they thought was going to be this great prince, does not turn out to be so because of that mysterious drop on the marble steps, which no one was supposed to know about. So... Chapter 2. And now he has no mother. He has his father, who is loving but confused about what's happening, as you will see. Everybody was very kind to the poor little prince. I think people generally are kind to motherless children, whether princes or peasants. He had a magnificent nursery and a regular suite of attendants, and was treated with the greatest respect and state. Nobody was allowed to talk to him in silly baby language, or dandle him, or above all to kiss him, though perhaps some people did it surreptitiously, for he was such a sweet baby that it was difficult to help it. It could not be said that the prince missed his mother. Children of his age cannot do that. But somehow after she died, everything seemed to go wrong with him. From a beautiful baby, he became sickly and pale, seeming to have almost ceased growing, especially in his legs, which had been so fat and strong. But after the day of his christening, they withered and shrank. He no longer kicked them out in either passion or play. And when, as he got to be nearly a year old, His nurse tried to make him stand upon them. He only tumbled down. This happened so many times that at last people began to talk about it. A prince, and not able to stand on his own legs. What a dreadful thing. What a misfortune for the country. Rather a misfortune for him also, poor little boy. But nobody seemed to think of that. And when, after a while, his health revived, and the old bright look came back to his sweet little face, and his body grew larger and stronger, though his legs remained the same, people continued to speak of him in whispers and with grave shakes of the head. Everybody knew, though nobody said it, that something, impossible to guess what, was not quite right with the poor little prince. Of course, nobody hinted this to the king, his father. It does not do to tell great people anything unpleasant. And besides, His Majesty took very little notice of his son, or of his other affairs, beyond the necessary duties of the kingdom. People said he would not miss the queen at all, she having been so long an invalid. But he did. After her death, he was never quite the same. He established himself in her empty rooms, the only rooms in the palace whence one could see the beautiful mountains, and was often observed looking at them as if he thought she had flown away thither, and that his longing could bring her back again. And by a curious coincidence, which nobody dared to inquire into, he desired that the prince might be called, not by any of the 24 grand names given him by his godfathers and godmothers, but by the identical name mentioned by the little old woman in gray, Dolor, after his mother, Dolores. Once a week, according to established state custom, the prince, dressed in his very best, was brought to the king, his father, for half an hour. But His Majesty was generally too ill and too melancholy to pay much heed to the child. Only once, when he and the crown prince, who was exceedingly attentive to his royal brother, the crown prince, remember, is the guy who wants to be king, were sitting together, with Prince Dolor playing in the corner of the room, dragging himself about with his arms rather than his legs, and sometimes feebly trying to crawl from one chair to another, it seemed to strike the father that all was not quite right with his son. "How old is His Royal Highness?" said he suddenly to the nurse.
2 years, 3 months, and 5 days, please, Your Majesty.
"It does not please me," said the king with a sigh. "He ought to be far more forward than he is now. Ought he not, brother? You, who have so many children, must know. Is there not something wrong about him?" "Oh, no," said the crown prince, exchanging meaning looks with the nurse, who did not understand at all, but stood frightened and trembling with tears in her eyes. "Nothing to make Your Majesty at all uneasy. No doubt His Royal Highness will outgrow it in time."
"Outgrow? What?"
"A slight delicacy in the spine. Something inherited, perhaps, from his dear mother."
"Ah, but she was always delicate. She was the sweetest woman that ever lived. Come here, my little son."
And as the prince turned round upon his father, a small, sweet, grave face, so like his mother's, His Majesty the king smiled and held out his arms. But when the boy came to him, not running like a boy, but wriggling awkwardly along the floor, the royal countenance clouded over.
I ought to have been told of this.
It is terrible. Terrible, and a prince, too. Send for all the doctors in my kingdom immediately. They came, and each gave a different opinion and ordered a different mode of treatment. The only thing they agreed in was that it had been pretty well known before, that the prince must have been hurt when he was an infant, let fall, perhaps, so as to injure his spine and lower limbs. Did nobody remember?
No, nobody.
Indignantly, all the nurses denied that any such accident had happened, was possible to have happened, until the faithful country nurse recollected that it really had happened on the day of the christening, for which, unluckily, good memory, all the others scolded her so severely that she had no peace of her life, and soon after, by the influence of the young lady nurse who had carried the baby that fatal day, and who was a sort of connection of the crown prince, the poor woman was pensioned off and sent to the beautiful mountains from whence she came, with orders to remain there for the rest of her days. But about this the king knew nothing.
And then we go on with the king knowing nothing for a while. And what happens, since we have a lot of action to get to, by the way, for all of you who are there, I am reading from The Little Lame Prince and His Traveling Cloak, a mysterious book from the 1940s by a woman named Miss Mullock. And it gets wonderful and melancholy, and I'm going to skip ahead to the action here. Now, what happens, obviously, is that the crown prince, who is the king's brother, is determined to take over the throne, seeing that the king is just lost in misery, and he doesn't want this invalid baby to take over, who is the baby is now the rightful heir. So what happens is that the crown prince starts to snicker about the little baby in public and speaks of how surely this boy cannot grow up to have any real power. There must be something wrong with him. So what happens is now, here we go. I'm going to skip ahead to this. So the baby's sliding around, wriggling and not walking, and the crown prince goes, let's see. I swear. Okay, I'll skip to what happens. I'm looking around going, where should I pick up? Okay, I'm going to pick up here, where the crown prince tells the king that if the king needs any help, the king's brother tells the king, if he needs any help, he will surely take over the kingdom. So the king finally, after so much pestering and suggestion, gives in and says, well, if this son does not grow up to seem capable of taking care of the kingdom, you can do it, brother. Scheming brother, that is. But the king is so lost in his misery, he doesn't see the scheming. So anyway, I swear, said the crown prince, coming forward and kissing the hilt of his sword, I swear to perform my duties as regent, to take all care of his royal highness, his majesty, I mean, with a grand bow to the little child, who laughed innocently back. And I will do my humble best to govern the country. Still, if the country has the slightest objection. But the crown prince, being generalissimo and having the whole army at his beck and call, so that he could have begun a civil war in no time, the country had not the slightest objection. So the king and queen, that is, the new king and queen, the brother and his wife, slept in peace, and Prince Dolor reigned over the land. That is, his uncle did. So that means that the prince is still prince in name only. Now the brother has everything. And everybody said what a fortunate thing it was for the poor little prince to have such a clever uncle to take care of him. All things went on as usual. Indeed, after the regent had brought his wife and her seven sons and established them in the palace, rather better than usual, for they gave such splendid entertainments and made the capital so lively that trade revived and the country was said to be more flourishing than it had been for a century. So in other words, the uncle and aunt are really partying it up and making the country popular again and fun again. And the prince, well, what happens to the rightful little prince? You shall see. Whenever the regent and his sons appeared, they were received with shouts, long live the crown prince! Long live the royal family! And in truth, they were very fine children, the whole seven of them, and made a great show when they rode out together on seven beautiful horses, one height above another, down to the youngest on his tiny black pony, no bigger than a large dog. As for the other child, his royal highness Prince Dolor, for somehow people soon ceased to call him His Majesty, which seemed such a ridiculous title for a poor little fellow, a helpless cripple with only head and trunk and no legs to speak of. He was seen very seldom by anybody. Sometimes people daring enough to peer over the high wall of the palace garden noticed there, carried in a footman's arms or drawn in a chair, or left to play on the grass, often with nobody to mind him, a pretty little boy with a bright, intelligent face and large, melancholy eyes. No, not exactly melancholy, for they were his mother's, and she was by no means sad-minded, but thoughtful and dreamy. They rather perplexed people, those childish eyes. They were so exceedingly innocent, and yet so penetrating. If anybody did a wrong thing, told a lie, for instance, they would turn round with such a grave, silent surprise. The child never talked much,
that every naughty person in the palace was rather afraid of Prince Dolor. He could not help it, and perhaps he did not even know it, being no better a child than many other children. But there was something about him which made bad people sorry, and grumbling people ashamed of themselves, and ill-natured people gentle and kind. I suppose because they were touched to see a poor little fellow who did not in the least know what had befallen him, or what lay before him, living his baby life as happy as the day was long. Anyway, I'm going to go on and skip to the point where the uncle schemes to completely get rid of this baby, which is just a few paragraphs down. Therefore, let's see. Ah, yes. So Miss Mullock says, the uncle didn't really mean to be cruel. He would never recognize himself as cruel. But one day he made a speech in front of the country saying that the little prince was in failing health, so he should be sent for a time to the mountains for some sort of therapeutic visit. And so what happens, to make a long story shorter, is that the little prince and a female prisoner from the female prison somewhere, who otherwise would have either faced death or this banishment, the prince and this female prisoner are banished to a tower way out in a desert, far away from the kingdom. And they're hoisted up in this pulley, and there's no door to get into the bottom of the castle. Everything has to be lifted to this high tower, which is just a tower, nothing else, by this pulley system. And for all anyone in the kingdom knows, the prince fell ill and is dead. And so now we're skipping ahead to the dismal part of this fairy tale. And what of the little lame prince whom everybody seemed to have so easily forgotten? Not everybody. There were a few kind souls, mothers of families who had heard his sad story, and some servants about the palace who had been familiar with his sweet ways. These many a time sighed and said, "Poor Prince Dolor!" or looking at the beautiful mountains, which were visible all over No Man's Land, though few people ever visited them, "Well, perhaps His Royal Highness is better where he is than even there." They did not know. Indeed, hardly anybody did know that beyond the mountains, beyond them and the sea, lay a tract of country, barren, level, bare, except for short stunted grass, and here and there a patch of tiny flowers. Not a bush, not a tree, not a resting place for bird or beast was in that dreary plain. In summer, the sunshine fell upon it hour after hour with a blinding glare. In winter, the winds and rain swept over it unhindered, and the snow came down, steadily, noiselessly, covering it from end to end in one great white sheet, which lay for days and weeks unmarked by a single footprint. Not a pleasant place to live in, and nobody did live there, apparently. The only sign that human creatures had ever been near the spot was one large round tower, which rose up in the center of the plain, and might be seen all over it, if there had been anybody to see, which there never was. Rose right up out of the ground, as if it had grown out of itself, like a mushroom. But it was not at all mushroom-like. On the contrary, it was very solidly built. In form it resembled the Irish round towers, which have puzzled people for so long, nobody being able to find out when or by whom or for what purpose they were made, seemingly for no use at all, like this tower. It was circular, a very firm brickwork, with neither doors nor windows until near the top, where you could perceive some slits in the wall through which one might possibly creep in or look out. Its height was nearly 100 feet high, and it had a battlemented parapet showing sharp against the sky. As the plain was quite desolate, almost like a desert, only without sand, and led to nowhere except the still more desolate seacoast, nobody ever crossed it. Whatever mystery there was about the tower, it and the sky and the plain kept their secret to themselves. Now, I shall skip ahead and say that once a month, I'm going to skip ahead because there's so much good stuff in here that I don't want to go on and take away from it. But here's another paragraph that'll give you the setting, and then we'll get to the action. One winter night. I should give it a little more. Okay, so this tower. Inside, though nobody could have looked inside except a bird, and hardly even a bird flew past that lonely tower. Inside, it was furnished with all the comforts and elegance imaginable, with lots of books and toys, and everything that the heart of a child could desire. For its only inhabitant, except a nurse, of course, was a poor little solitary child. One winter night, when all the plain was white with moonlight, there was seen crossing it a great tall black horse, ridden by a man also big and equally black, carrying before him on the saddle a woman and a child. The woman, she had a sad, fierce look, and no wonder, for she was a criminal under sentence of death, but her sentence had been changed to almost as severe a punishment. She was to inhabit the lonely tower with the child, and was allowed to live as long as the child lived. No longer. This, in order that she might take the utmost care of him, for those who put him there were equally afraid of his dying and of his living. And yet he was only a little gentle boy with a sweet, sleepy smile. He had been very tired with his long journey, and clinging arms which held tight to the man's neck, for he was rather frightened, and the face, black as it was, looked kindly at him. And he was very helpless with his poor, small, shriveled legs, which could neither stand nor run away, for the little forlorn boy was Prince Dolor. Skipping ahead a bit. So the servant taking them there is deaf and dumb, so he cannot tell or repeat, or, you know, some sort of precaution that has been taken, so the servant is deaf and dumb, but has gentle eyes, we see. When they reached the foot of the tower, there was light enough to see a huge chain dangling from the parapet, but dangling only halfway. The deaf mute took from his saddle a wallet, a sort of ladder arranged in pieces like a puzzle, fitted it together, and lifted it up to meet the chain. Then he mounted to the top of the tower and slung from it a sort of chair, in which the woman and the child placed themselves and were drawn up, never to come down again as long as they lived. And so you get the picture. Every month the servant appears, and only once a month, and it says, like a speck in the distance. He brings food, new clothing, other various things. He has to ensure that the child and servant are alive and well, and at least give that information back to the scheming uncle who now is in charge of the kingdom. So now we say his nurse was very kind to him, though she was a wicked woman. But either she had not been quite so wicked as people said, or she grew better through being shut up continually with a little innocent child who was dependent upon her for every comfort and pleasure of his life. It was not an unhappy life. There was nobody to tease or ill-use him, and he was never ill. He played about from room to room. There were four rooms, parlor, kitchen, his nurse's bedroom, and his own. He learned to crawl like a fly, and to jump like a frog, and to run about on all fours, almost as fast as a puppy. In fact, he was very much like a puppy or a kitten, as thoughtless and as merry, scarcely ever cross, though sometimes a little weary. As he grew older, he occasionally liked to be quiet for a while, and then he would sit at the slits of windows, which were, however, much bigger than they looked from the bottom of the tower, and he would watch the sky above and ground below, with the storm sweeping over, and the sunshine coming and going, and the shadows of the clouds running races across the blank plain. By and by, he began to learn lessons. Not that his nurse had been ordered to teach him, but she did it partly to amuse herself. She was not a stupid woman, and Prince Dolor was by no means a stupid boy, so they got on very well, and his continual entreaty, "What can I do? What can you find me to do?" was stopped, at least for an hour or two in the day. It was a dull life, but he had never known any other. Anyhow, he remembered no other, and he did not pity himself at all. Not for a long time, till he grew to be quite a big little boy and could read easily. Then he suddenly took to books, which the deaf mute brought him from time to time, books which, not being acquainted with the literature of no man's land, I cannot describe, but no doubt they were very interesting, and they informed him of everything in the outside world, and filled him with an intense longing to see it. From this time, a change came over the boy. He began to look sad and thin, and to shut himself up for hours without speaking. For his nurse hardly spoke, and whatever questions he asked, beyond their ordinarily... for his nurse hardly spoke, and whatever questions he asked beyond their ordinary daily life, she never answered. She had indeed been forbidden, on pain of death, to tell him anything about himself, who he was or what he might have been. He knew he was Prince Dolor, because she always addressed him as my prince and your royal highness. But what a prince was he? He had not the least idea. He had no idea of anything in the world, except what he found in his books. He sat one day surrounded by them, having built them up round him like a little castle wall. He had been reading them half the day, but feeling all the while that to read about things which you can never see is like hearing about a beautiful dinner while you were starving. For almost the first time in his life he grew melancholy. His hands fell on his lap. He sat gazing out of the window slit upon the view outside, the view he had looked at every day of his life and might look at for endless days more. Not a very cheerful view, just the plain and sky, but he liked it. He used to think if he could only fly out of that window, up to the sky or down to the plain, how nice it would be. Perhaps when he died, his nurse told him once in anger that he would never leave the tower till that he would never leave the tower till he died. Perhaps then he might be able to fly. Not that he understood much what dying meant, but it must be a change, and any change seemed to him a blessing. I wish I had somebody to tell me all about it. About that and many other things, somebody that would be fond of me like my poor white kitten. Here the tears came into his eyes, for the boy's one friend, the one interest of his life, had been a little white kitten, which the deaf mute, kindly smiling, once took out of his pocket and gave him, the only living creature Prince Dolor had ever seen. For 4 weeks it was his constant plaything and companion, till one moonlight night it took a fancy for wandering, climbed onto the parapet of the tower, dropped over and disappeared. It was not killed, he hoped, for cats have 9 lives. Indeed, he almost fancied he saw it pick itself up and scamper away, but he never caught sight of it any more. Yes, I wish I had something better than a kitten, a person, a real live person who would be fond of me and kind to me. Oh, I want somebody, dreadfully, dreadfully. As he spoke, there sounded behind him a slight tap, 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 as of a stick or a cane. And twisting himself around, he saw... What do you think he saw? Nothing either frightening or ugly, but still exceedingly curious. A little woman, no bigger than he might himself have been, had his legs grown like those of other children. But she was not a child. She was an old woman. Her hair was gray and her dress was gray, and there was a gray shadow over her wherever she moved. But she had the sweetest smile, the prettiest hands, and when she spoke, it was in the softest voice imaginable. My dear little boy. And dropping her cane, the only bright and rich thing about her, she laid those 2 tiny hands on his shoulders. My own little boy, I could not come to you until you had said you wanted me. But now you do want me. Here I am. And you are very welcome, madam, replied the prince, trying to speak politely, as princes always did in books. And I am exceedingly obliged to you. May I ask who you are? Perhaps my mother. For he knew that little boys usually had a mother, and had occasionally wondered what had become of his own. No, said the visitor, with a tender, half-sad smile, putting back the hair from his forehead and looking right into his eyes. No, I am not your mother, though she was a dear friend of mine, and you are as like her as ever you will be. Will you tell her to come and see me, then? She cannot, but I dare say she knows all about you, and she loves you very much, and so do I, and I want to help you all I can, my poor little boy. Why do you call me poor? Asked Prince Dolor in surprise. The little old woman glanced down on his legs and feet, which he did not know were different from those of other children, and then at his sweet, bright face, which, though he knew not that either, was exceedingly different from many children's faces, which are so often fretful, cross, sullen. Looking at him, instead of sighing, she smiled. I beg your pardon, my prince, said she. So anyway, because we must sweep ahead to the action, I will tell you that she, that they, ah, yes, here's a sad little part. And so she gives him more consolation and says, I cannot alter your lot in any way, but I can help you to bear it. And then he says, thank you, but why do you talk of bearing it? I have nothing to bear. My poor little man, said the old woman in the very tenderest tone of her tender voice, kiss me. What is kissing? Asked the wondering child. So then, of course, she gives him a big hug and kisses him. And he says to her, you are better to cuddle than even my little white kitten, I think. Promise me that you will never go away. And she says, I must, but I will leave a present behind me, something as good as myself to amuse you, something that will take you wherever you want to go and show you all that you wish to see. What is it? A traveling cloak. So anyway, we must get to the traveling. So anyway, she gives him this cloak, and he doesn't understand what traveling is, but he is excited about it. She tries to explain to him that he should try it on and use it. And I will skip ahead, and let's see. I shall skip ahead far into the story, to the part where he learns to use his traveling cloak. Now, what happens is that for a long while, he actually forgets he has the traveling cloak. It's dark gray and indistinguishable, and I think that his cleaning lady protector, nurse, quickly put it on a shelf with his other toys, and he quickly forgot that it existed. And so much later on, the fairy godmother comes back and says, have you used it yet? And so he ends up going, being surprised and at the last minute finding it. And anyway, we shall see what happens now. I will skip ahead to some of his adventures with the cloak. He learns the magic commands to open his skylight of the thing, and then this cloak opens up. You sort of put it on, and it turns into this shimmering gray bowl beneath you, and then you can step into it. And so for the first time in his life, he's watched these birds going back and forth outside of his window forever, because he can see the birds in the sky, and he wishes he knew where they went to. So anyway, I'm going to give you a little bit of the joy he experiences when he starts traveling. Cool mist. Should the little prince feel frightened? He gets frightened. He goes out into the desert a little bit, and he gets frightened, and then he finds a way to race back quickly. But then I'm skipping ahead and seeing he has more and more adventures. Oh, here's one where he's going kind of slow. He's shuttling by in the sky a little bit. He hasn't gotten out of the desert yet, and these birds fly past him. The boy looked after them with envy. And so then he goes back to his tower, and after seeing that the birds can go faster than him still, he gets very sad and doesn't use his cloak for a few days. And all right, let's see. Now that the servant comes who delivers them food, he sees the servant wandering off into the distance, and that gives him hope again. He goes, no, I must find out where that man is going. Surely he comes from somewhere. And so he dares himself to go further than he ever has gone, to a different sort of land. So here we go. Certainly he's read about different sorts of land in his books. Okay, so he's shuttled through the sky. He's getting tired, but at the last minute when he's going, he's tired, it's getting dark. Here we go. The sunshiny day changed to rain, and being high up in the very midst of the clouds, he got soaked through and through in a very few minutes. Shall I turn back? Meditated he. Suppose I say abracadabra. Here he stopped, for already the cloak gave an obedient lurch, as if it were expecting to be sent home immediately. No, I can't. I can't go back. I must go forward and see the world. But oh, if I had but the shabbiest old rug to shelter me from the rain, or the driest morsel of bread and cheese just to keep me from starving. Still, I don't much mind. I'm a prince, and ought to be able to stand anything. Hold on, cloak. We'll make the best of it. Anyway, let's just say that the cloak has certain magical qualities, and it forms this
bear feeling furry rug that comes up and cradles him. Then he gets this food that is neither like meat or pudding, but somehow a combination of both, and the most delicious thing he's ever had in his life. And so, anyway, helped out by a little warmth, and he's even able to take a little nap in his flying cloak. He gets further on into the night, and he gets further on into a place he has never seen before. And he's still in the air. Imagine he's in this weird, shimmering, gray fabric disc in the air. Okay. In a new land. It's rained. It's gotten cold. He's eaten his meat but not pudding. Now he's in a new land. When he awoke, he found himself floating over a country that was quite unlike anything he had ever seen before. Yet it was nothing but what most of you children see every day and never notice it. A pretty country landscape, like England, Scotland, France, or any other land you choose to name. It had no particular features, nothing in it grand or lovely. It was simply pretty, nothing more. Yet to Prince Dolor, who had never gone beyond his lonely tower and level plain, it appeared the most charming sight imaginable. First, there was a river. It came tumbling down the hillside, frothing and foaming, playing at hide-and-seek among rocks, then bursting out in noisy fun like a child to bury itself in deep, still pools. And then we get this river. It's so active, so alive. I like things active and alive, cried he, and watched it shimmering and dancing, whirling and leaping, till, after a few windings and vagaries, it settled into a respectable stream. So anyway, the prince keeps following the river, and sometimes it's hard for him to see too many things, because sometimes he's too high up, so he has these magic gold spectacles he can look through. And so that helps him see things. And so there's this great illustration of him wearing his golden spectacles, looking down. Finally, he gets enough courage to go down and almost touch a tree. Okay, only think to have lived his age, and never seen trees. As he floated over these oaks, they seemed to him, trunk, branches, and leaves, the most curious sight imaginable. If I only could get nearer to them as to touch them. So he gets his cloak to come down, and let's see, it looks like he grabs a couple leaves, and they fall into his cloak, and he shuttles up again. Ah, and here's a sad part. So he's going over a field, and what does he finally see? Okay, godmother. Okay, so he sees all these sheep, and he's in this habit of talking to his cloak because he knows that somehow the godmother can hear him. Maybe she is the cloak itself. And suddenly he looks down and sees a boy. Godmother, a boy who's a shepherd with all these sheep and a sheepdog. Godmother, all these creatures I like exceedingly, but I should like better to see a creature like myself. Couldn't you show me just one little boy? There was a sigh behind him. It might have only been the wind. And the cloak remained so long balanced motionless in the air that he was half afraid his godmother had forgotten him or was offended with him for asking too much. Suddenly a shrill whistle startled him, even through his silver ears, which I guess are these special ears he has to hear things on the ground a little better, since he's usually very high up from it. Suddenly a shrill whistle startled him, even through his silver ears, and looking downwards, he saw start up from behind a bush on a common something. Neither a sheep, nor a horse, nor a cow, nothing on four legs. This creature had only two, but they were long, straight, and strong, and it had a lithe, active body, and a curly head of black hair set upon its shoulders. It was a boy, a shepherd boy, about the prince's own age, but oh, so different. And you get the picture. So the little prince is in his cloak going, might he play with me? But then the shepherd boy seems a bit startled, and the sheepdog starts barking at the prince. And you can imagine how perplexing all of this is to the prince, who's still in his cloak. And then he sees the shepherd get frightened and start running away, because obviously all the shepherd sees is this strange head poking out of a flying silver disc, wearing gold spectacles and silver special hearing ears. So So Prince Dolor is something in his cloak that the shepherd has never seen before. And even though the shepherd runs away in fright, Prince Dolor is going, how nice it must be to run like that. And so, and then the prince goes, I think I had rather not look at him again, because then the boy realizes he's sad. You're no good to me, he said, patting them mournfully, which I guess he's patting his legs, yes. You will never be any good to me. I wonder why I had you at all. I wonder why I was born at all, since I was not to grow up like other little boys. So, anyway, it is at this time that I'll quickly, in the last couple minutes of the show, since I'm getting towards the end, but I'm not going to reach the end, and I shouldn't even spoil the end anyway. Maybe one of you out there will one day be able to find this exceptionally rare book called The Little Lame Prince and His Traveling Cloak, which by Miss Mullick, which if I had a guess, I would imagine she's a librarian in Omaha in 1943 somewhere. But you never know. Maybe you too can find a copy of this. But I will give you one last melancholy thing. So, and there is a happy ending. I will tell you that much. So even this boy will have a happy ending. He won't ever learn to use his legs, but he will have other good things come to him in life. So he's sadly seen the shepherd boy run away from him and going, oh, why am I not like that? And so he starts going further and further up into the sky, trying to get away from that. And he sees a bird going by. The song of a skylark, mounting higher and higher from the ground, till it came so close that Prince Dolor could distinguish its quivering wings and tiny body, almost too tiny to contain such a gush of music. Oh, you beautiful, beautiful bird, cried he. I should dearly like to take you in and cuddle you. That is, if I could, if I dared. But he hesitated. The little brown creature with its loud, heavenly voice almost made him afraid. Nevertheless, it also made him happy, and he watched and listened, so absorbed that he forgot all about regret and pain, forgot everything in the world except the little lark. It soared and soared, and he was just wondering if it would soar out of sight, and what in the world he should do when it was gone, when suddenly it closed its wings as larks do when they mean to drop to the ground. But instead of dropping to the ground, it dropped right onto the boy's breast. What felicity! If it would only stay, a tiny soft thing to fondle and kiss, to sing to him all day long and be his playfellow companion, yada, yada, yada. You can imagine.
Hey, wait.
As the traveling cloak traveled on, now he makes this wonderful friend, this lark. And so, anyway, let's see. What happens? My pretty bird, what am I to do with you? If I take you into my room and shut you up there, you, a wild skylark of the air, what will become of you? I am used to this, but you are not. You will be so miserable, and suppose my nurse should find you, she who can't bear the sound of singing. Besides, I remember her once telling me that the nicest thing she ever ate in her life was lark pie. The boy shivered all over at the thought. And though the merry lark immediately broke into the loudest carol, as if saying derisively that he defied anybody to eat him, still Prince Dolor was very uneasy. In another minute he had made up his mind. No, my bird, nothing so dreadful shall happen to you if I can help it. I would rather do without you altogether. Yes, I'll try. Fly away, my darling, my beautiful. Goodbye, my merry, merry bird. And so Prince Dolor lets the lark go, but it doesn't fly away after all. So apparently, once the boy goes back to the tower, it hovers around the tower and keeps watch for it and sings so that the boy can still hear it. And so then he went to sleep as happy as a king, as he recognizes his lark is going to stay with him. And there is much more that happens. I will simply say, to get away with the plot, that the nurse finally decides to break her vow of silence and tell the boy he's the rightful heir of the kingdom and that his scheming uncle stole the throne. And the boy, with a little help from some birds, who will talk to him after a while, does get to go back to the kingdom and see how unhappy and unpleasant the reign of the uncle really is, even though it seems like it's all fun and games. And something more happens. But you may have to find your own copy of The Little Lame Prince and His Traveling Cloak. It is a wonderful book by Miss M-U-L-O-C-K Mulock. So, you've been listening to Night of the Living Tongue, a fairy tale episode this evening. And maybe sometime later on I'll read you the end of this, if you remember. And if I remember. So, next week, back to the music with the Rectangles. They will blow your socks off and any other article of clothing you happen to be wearing that night, because they are fast, powerful, whimsical, goofy. The Rectangles, pop but not pop. And then the week after that will be something that's not pop at all, something that's rumbling and druidic and has an appropriate name for that. The rumbling analog synthesizer drum soloing fantasia of Dark Age, or New Dark Age. They changed their name a bit. But anyway, some sort of Dark Age will be the last week of the month. Coming up next month will be Realicide and some more stuff. So stay tuned next Thursday for Night of the Living Tongue, every Thursday this time. And now for Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura.